This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 308 for Wednesday, March 6th, 2019. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Once again, Megan Townsend is back this week. You can find her at Megan Townsend on all the social media that matters. How's your day going?
Oh, it's not bad. How are you?
I'm good. It's the midweek crunch, I guess. I feel like my day has vaporized. Normally, you and I, when we sit down, we record somewhere around noonish on Wednesdays, and you usually don't have much going on Wednesdays, and working from home and quite flexible, so it works out. And I have to say that I have been switching to podcasting during the day more often than I am in the evenings, and I find it a lot easier to do. I have a lot more energy at like 12 to 3 or even 10 a.m. than I do at 9 p.m. sometimes. And so I've been trying to steer it that way. I mean, obviously I don't mind doing it at night because, I mean, Brockett and Lou and some of the other people that we have on the show require evening podcasts. But I lost my morning to tech support, troubleshooting my own computer woes. Some of them brought on by me. Some of them brought on by just programs that should talk to one another, not talking to one another. And it's one of those things, like, I listen to a lot of daily tech news. The Daily Tech News Show is probably one of my favorite podcasts. I know I've mentioned it on the show a number of times. And so I feel like, you know, hearing what they talk about and hearing how all these advances in software and all these things are working together and there's all these different things, and I don't see it. And sometimes they're not talking about the future. Sometimes they're talking about these things are available right now, or these are the things that were talked about 6 months ago that are now implemented in these things. I see the integration and the ease of use in some things like Google Docs, you know, Gmail, and some things like that. But there are other things that I'm not seeing. And I know that we can't get into some super details on the show, but for me personally right now, my frustration has been lying with the Adobe suite of creative apps, which I pay money for monthly.
Right.
In subscription. Yeah. And people are like, well, Joel, it's only $50, you know, $53 or $52 US. Like, well, that's $80 Canadian right now with the exchange, thanks to the economy. And it's getting to the point where, like, while I use most of the apps, I just am bewildered as to why a suite of apps from one company can't seem to work together. Like, the left hand cannot seem to know what the right hand is doing when it comes to stuff like Premiere and After Effects or Photoshop and Illustrator. Now, there are positives. The last book that I designed with Photoshop and Adobe InDesign, beautiful, worked seamlessly. You know, you go into a Photoshop file, you update that file, you hit refresh on InDesign, the images refresh, so you know that you've made the right adjustment. Beautiful. Loved it. You know, but then I tried to use something like Illustrator and all the tools are in the wrong place, or the things that make sense in Photoshop, they've changed it arbitrarily for Illustrator. And I know some design friends that swear by Illustrator, and that's fine. Yeah. And I'm sure that if I had the time and had the, you know, to get to know yet another piece of software, that I would also find working it easier. But then you just have that mind share of flipping back and forth and back and forth between different applications. And I've heard something similar, but in a positive light, when people talk about the application Procreate and saying how similar it is to Photoshop. And there's a software development company that's different from Adobe, but took a look at how many artists in the industry use Photoshop at one point in their careers or another and say, okay, well, we can't copy Photoshop, but there's a certain language, there's a certain vernacular to layers, what a brush is expected to do, you know, what a blend mode is expected to do, and the name of that blend mode. And I feel like by not rocking the boat, they have quite quickly, I've seen, adopted a huge user base in the people that I follow online, because within 15 or 20 minutes, you're going to notice some differences, but the similarities are just going to quickly fall into your creative workflow and muscle memory so that you can work very easily in Procreate if you happen to be a Photoshop user.
Yeah, I've used Procreate and I love it. I mean, I'm not an illustrator or an artist really, but I think it's fantastic. I don't know. On my Instagram, I posted a drawing that I did of like space painting.
Nice.
Also, sorry if my mic just did something weird. My cat just came in and his tail brushed all over the mic.
This is the cat butt podcast.
The cat butt podcast. I thought I had my door closed, but he just kind of came in, was just like, oh, hi.
Oh, cats can open doors. You didn't know that?
I didn't know this wood could. Usually it's pretty tightly closed. Hi, buddy. Sorry about that. I started to derail for a second. I've used Procreate. I did a drawing that I put up on Instagram of like a spacescape, and I had a couple planets in there, or like two planets or something. And I had a light beam and things, and it's really cool. It's got some really fun features in it, and it looks really nice, and it's relatively easy. Like, it's, I think it's a bit of a learning curve for sure.
Oh, sure. I mean, everything is, and I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a curve from one program to the other, because I mean, they're different programs for different reasons. Otherwise it would all be under one program, right?
Right. Yeah, but no, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, I think it's a great program. I think, especially if, I think, is it iPad exclusive?
Procreate? I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but that seems to be what it's prevalent on. But it could have other stuff. I mean, I could look it up, I guess. It's not like I'm not sitting in front of the internet.
Right. Computer. It's not like it's at our fingertips, ready to go.
It looks like it's an exclusive iOS. Yes.
iOS.
Yeah.
Okay.
From what I can see.
Yeah.
From a quick look, it looks like an iOS thing. It's a large user base. So like you'd want to take advantage of that. I feel like the biggest issue that I have right now is like, while I understand, like for me, the latest example was doing some things in After Effects. I edited a lot of my videos and stuff in Premiere. So After Effects, I had to do some animation and some things, some graphic, motion graphics and things for client. And I'm trying to export it in a format that works correctly. And it's just like, well, it's so limiting in terms of the export formats that you have compared to Premiere. And it's just like, well, why isn't this the same? You know, like even if the capabilities of the program are different and maybe the rendering engine is has some limitations, the UI on export should still be the same as every other Adobe video, like as Premiere, not identical, but the UI, I should be able to go in and find the file name and the encoder and the resolution and all that kind of stuff in much the same way that I do in Premiere, which I find very straightforward. And it's one of those things where it's like, why is it different? It boils down to the design of, say, like the toolbar in Illustrator versus Photoshop. Like everything is in a different spot, and everything is like, and some things have a different function, even though they're both type tools or they're both brush tools, and it's just like, well, but why does the arrow tool do something different in this program than the other program? Mm. Why is it a different hotkey for starters? I mean, sure.
I almost wish it was like, there was like a standard. It's like, are you making a software? Here's a standard.
Well,
here's
this
a formula.
Exactly. And this is the thing. And so many other times, like for example, hotkeys in Premiere for, the cut tool, the arrow tool, different tools like that are similar to Photoshop. It's V for the arrow and like space for play and pause. And in Photoshop, the thing that you use the most is, I think, the space bar for grabbing the canvas and panning around. And so space bar in Premiere is stop and start your playback, which again, you're hitting a lot, right? So it makes sense that it's the big button on your keyboard. And so stuff like that makes sense. But then in Illustrator, now I don't remember all the key commands because I'm not in there very much. I find that like the tools that you want to use to do that kind of stuff are different and they have different hotkeys. It's like, well, but why did you rock the boat? Like I could be in here and working just as fast, you know, using different tools, if at least the interface looked the same and worked the same. Anyway, I've just been frustrated a lot with how long it takes me to learn how to do the exact same thing I'm doing within the suite of apps from Adobe that, you know, that I'm working in. And yet all I'm doing is just going laterally into a different program. Now, before people send in any messages or make any comments about the Adobe Media Encoder, I know that that exists, and I know that the use for it is that you can send all of your rendering to one interface and then learn how to use that interface, and then that becomes like the catch-all. So sure, but it's yet another app that I have to have open and running. Also, I've been having issues with the latest version. So all the 2019 Adobe stuff doesn't work. It's so slow to the point where it impedes my workflow. So I'm paying for the latest versions of everything because I have a subscription to Creative Cloud, and yet I am on the 2018 versions of Photoshop, Premiere, and Adobe Media Encoder because the changes that they made are just so bad. Like, it gets you open up Photoshop and it takes forever, and it chugs and does all these things, and you kind of wonder, like, did anyone open this software before they released it? Like, did they actually test it on something that wasn't like a computer hooked up to a diesel engine? You know, because it runs fine. Well, it runs fine when you're maybe at Adobe on like the latest, greatest, you know, goes like snot machine. But the average consumer, if you're not operating on these specs, then it's kind of problematic, you know, to your workflow when stuff like that slows down. I mean, when I'm charging hourly, that matters, you know, to me.
Yeah.
You know, or vice versa, when I'm doing contract work, when I don't have an hourly and I have a set budget. It's like, well, if this takes me 10 hours versus 8, that's a big difference for me, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like to eat dinner at 6 o'clock, not 8 o'clock, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's things like that I've been very, and I lost the whole morning to just crap like that. So that's kind of my rant. But if anybody out there has any good YouTube tutorials for After Effects or Premiere or even Illustrator, let me know, share them with me. Cause I'll be quick to say that, like, there's a lot of stuff I don't know about these programs, and I'm sure I could be educated in a way that might help the workflow. And there might be other people out there that have, you know, made videos about, here's a workaround, here's how to get past this crazy Adobe, you know, hump that everybody has to go through. Doesn't change my opinion on the fact that the hump exists, but if there's a way for me to work around it and not have to deal with it, then I would very much appreciate any kind of tips. I did find one guy that was very intuitive and fun and informative, and that's Peter McKinnon. He's a photographer, and he goes over like Lightroom and After Effects and some stuff. And I found that his videos were like concise, and he's like, hey, there's a lot that you can do with this program. Here's what we're going to do. Just this. And we're going to focus on this, and you might be able to extrapolate these skills into something else. But like, I'm not going to get too complicated, and I'm not going to go too fast. You know, like, we're going to go through this step by step. And I can't remember the other guy's name, Matt something. I've talked about him on the show before too, and he had like export settings for Premiere. I watched that tutorial years ago, a year ago, when I was first starting to make YouTube videos and learning those ropes, and that saved a lot of time and a lot of, you know, experimentation on my end to be just like, nope, okay, he says do it this way, I'm going to do it this way and see what it works.
Right.
See how it works. You save that preset and then never have to worry about it again, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that
I need to get better at, about saving presets. Like, I don't do presets. And I know I probably should do presets like in Final Cut Pro and stuff. And I don't. So I find that I'm always going back and kind of redoing the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I have a template in Premiere that I use, and I use presets, and it takes my editing time down from like 2 hours to like 20 minutes.
Yeah, I need to do that, because I find I spend so much time editing my videos, and I'm trying to find like one particular song to use as like my opening theme song, and I feel like I had one a little bit, but now I'm doing like a channel rebrand and everything, and you know, going in like a sort of different mood. Well, not really much a different mood, but like a different sort of aesthetic, I guess. So I need my, you know, music and graphics to reflect all that. So it's trying to find, you know, some of the new stuff that I need. But once I get back into, I need to get we were talking about external hard drives before the show. I need to get one of those before I can get back into video editing and stuff again, but definitely something I want to get back into. But presets, thank you for that reminder, because I'm going to need to use that eventually.
Yeah, there's some things that I can't save presets on that drive me nuts. I use a push transition, you know, in Premiere quite a bit, and just because it's a fast way to like cut to a different scene. And
yeah.
I always have to change the length of the push transition. With all the other transitions, you can cross dissolve, you can save a 2 second cross dissolve, you can save a 15 frame cross dissolve, but push, nope, they don't let you change it. It's just default 30. You can't change it to 15 frames no matter what you do. It's like, well, that's why? why do all these other options exist? Like, I can tweak the rest of this program to my heart's content, and yet this one thing doesn't have, you know, that capability, and it's in the same bin as everything else. It's like there's some things like that get overlooked. I really, really don't understand. But anyway, this week I have been in the weirdest mood when it comes to content consumption. I've not really been able to decide on anything new to try. I kind of wanted to go into some fantasy kind of stuff, but I've recently already watched Lord of the Rings, so that was out. And you and I had a conversation, I think it was a couple weeks ago, about D&D, and that kind of had me going down that tunnel of like, man, I would really like to do some like fantasy MMO or experience this kind of stuff. So what I ended up landing on, because they started to show up on Netflix again, oddly not all of them, but only a handful of the Harry Potter
the
films.
Second half.
Yeah. So 5, 6, and then 7 Part 1, 7 Part 2. So that's the Order of the Phoenix, the Half-Blood Prince, and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1 and 2 are all on
And I have
Netflix.
To say that's a really weird place to start, because I feel like The Goblet of Fire is kind of where the huge turning point happens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge Harry Potter nerd. You've opened up a can of worms. As soon as you're like, I'm watching this, I'm like, well, you're in my wheelhouse now. All right, let's play.
That's good, because you're going to be able to correct when I make mistakes, and you're going to be able to clarify things that I don't remember, because I've only ever watched all of the movies once through. The last time I saw The Deathly Hallows, they were in theaters, which is like 10 years ago.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, for me, it's like an annual thing.
Oh,
once
yeah, no.
A year around
I can't,
Christmas time, let's watch
I,
all of them.
I can't do it. I can't do it annually. I can't even do it that often. Mostly because I like elements of them, but I don't find any of them to be particularly good movies.
They're not.
You know, like I don't find them overall. I mean, it's a cool world. Like, I mean, the world building, and what I find most entertaining about them is like, you know, something really neat and magical happens, and you're like, oh, huh, right, okay. It's a plant that moves, or, you know, this is how house elves work, or like, oh, wait a minute, they're magical? I don't remember that. Like, so there's all these different things that come into it that I think are really interesting. And I have to say that, I remember liking most of the Order of the Phoenix. And so when I was rewatching it, I was like, okay, yeah, I remember seeing this in theaters. I remember this one. It's a more serious film, and things start to get a little bit more, you know, intense. And there's like that quirky, I don't remember her name, but she's the teacher that has the pink flowers and everything. Umbridge. Yeah, sure. So it's a, you know, kind of a classic fantasy cartoon villain where it's like, she's so sweet and so, you know, cheery that you know that it's just all bad. Like, it's just, it's the kind of like 1950s, you know, chauvinism and racism and like all the kind of things that represents, that she represents in terms of the rules and conservative values. In Harry Potter, it's more about muggles versus magical. What do they call people that have magic? Purebloods?
Wizards.
Wizards.
The purebloods are like, so I guess in the point of Harry Potter that it's at now, like Harry himself is considered a half-blood wizard, because his dad was a pureblood wizard, but his mom was a muggle-born. That makes him half-blood because he's got muggle family.
Mm-hmm.
Hermione's a muggle-born because she's like...
Both of her parents are
like
are
both of her parents are not wizards at all. Ron's family is one of the last pure blood families left, meaning that they are purely wizards. There's no muggle ancestry in their family at all. But most people, you know, I think Hagrid says at one point, I think he says in the second movie, because Malfoy uses. He calls Hermione a mudblood, which is like a derogatory slang word. for people who have, you know, muggle blood in them. And Hagrid even says there's not a wizard today who's either, you know, like half blood or less these days. Like, it's very rare that someone is a pure blood wizard family still. Mm-hmm. And those who are have a lot of pride about them. Some of them have a lot of pride about that. Mm-hmm. The Weasleys could not care less. They're just like, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think at its heart, the series has a lot of very interesting connotations to it. It definitely does get into a root of like racism, I think, a little bit, which is really, it does it in kind of like an interesting way that mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's not blatant, but when you really sit and think about it, you're like, oh, that's a good, I guess, example for like racism and, you know, concentration camps and being like, you know,
segregation, what's the word I'm looking for? Segregation, interrogation. Once you get into the Deathly Hallows and even the Half-Pressed Blood Prince, there's definitely an overtone of like, you know, neo-Nazi, World War II. Like, not to mention that the whole, from a film perspective, everything just kind of goes gray. There is just no color in any of the films from 5 through 7, really. Well, 5 maybe a little bit, but 6 and 7, there's no, everything's very muted. It's all very gray and drab and dark, and there's a lot,
very, very dark.
A lot of things are happening at night and all this kind of stuff. And
those I think are my favorite, like 5, like Half-Blood Prince, and then Deathly Hallows. I think in terms of, maybe not in terms of tone, but in terms of production value and
they're still well made films. I have a hard time. I can't criticize the story too much, having one, never read all the books, and two, not being so familiar with the movies that, you know, over the course of 7 films or 8 films, there's just a lot of content. So for me to jump in and watch 5, 6, 7 and judge any kind of story bits that I'm missing, I was like, well, this could be harkening back to something in the 3rd movie that I just don't remember. Whereas somebody that has read the books would know precisely, you know, even just with one read through, they still might know exactly who they're talking about. And I find that the number of people, especially when you start to get into like conspiracy theories and stuff in the Ministry of Magic and like who's been corrupted and who hasn't been and all this kind of stuff. What even is the ministry? Like, there's all these kind of things that I don't necessarily remember. And half the people's names sound the same, you know, it's all made up stuff. Like, no one has like, you know, John McDonald is not, you know, anybody important. It's always like, you know, I can't even think of, you know, something Humperdinck, you know, like Applethorne Humperdinck is like this important person. He's like, who now? Like, and it's like, it's the first time you've ever heard that, which is great. Like, it's one of those things where, you know, if you're not familiar with the series, then it becomes brain overload, you know, like everybody is just like, you know, unless it's, you know, Hermione or Ron or Harry, then like those people, you know, and you see, but they're the supporting staff, even if they are friends or cousins or brothers or parents or whoever, there's so many of them. By the time you get into the 7th movie, there's like 13 or 14 people in this core resistance. You're just like, I don't know who half these people are, you know?
The books definitely take that mystery out of it for sure. Mm. I find lately what I've been doing, especially with like, if I haven't read a book to something, and I'm watching an adaptation, I'll often watch it with subtitles, which drives a lot of people I know nuts. Like, it drives my brother crazy. But I recently, like, just going through watching Game of Thrones again, I was, had the subtitles on for the whole time. And I was like, oh, now I know exactly who these people are. Because sometimes you miss someone's name. Someone just says their name kind of like really quickly in passing, and then you just forget it altogether. Like, you just don't quite catch it. So seeing it with subtitles, you're like, oh, that's a name. They're referencing a person there. Okay, I get it. And I found that, like, I mean, having read Harry the whole series multiple times, because I'm one of those people. Again, annual read. Like, I will read the movies, books once a year. It's like, it's a thing. I don't know. It's a lot easier to pinpoint who's who when they're talked about in text. Because you see their name, you see, you know, how they relate. When you're dealing with a film, they may not mention the name all the time. Like, there's a character named Kingsley, and people don't often notice Kingsley. In the beginning of Order of the Phoenix, the group of people who come in and, like, you know, rescue Harry from his aunt and uncle's place. There's, like, a very, very select group of people.
Yes.
Is that number five? I think that's number five. There's a guy who's wearing, like, purple robes. He's got dark skin. His name is Kingsley Shacklebolt, and he is pretty important in the books, but from, like, a behind-the-scenes perspective. Like, he's referenced a lot, but you never actually see him a lot, but he's referenced quite a bit. But, you know, Harry only sees him a handful of times, but, like, knows him enough to be like, oh, this guy. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the good people, but you only see him for maybe, like, 15 seconds in the actual movie. So he doesn't make as much of an impact.
Yeah, and they do they do a lot in the films to have him show up next to Dumbledore, Sirius Black. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I can't remember the professor's name that has the woggly eye and the cane.
Mad-Eye Moody.
Yeah.
Alistair Moody.
Yeah. So, but you see him with those people who you also equate with, like, the higher up, you know, like they're either more powerful wizards, more important wizards in terms of their social stature, or they've just been around longer and they just know more. And they tend to pair him in scenes, whether he's talking or not, with those people. So you kind of, you know, get that importance by, you know, association.
Yeah.
The stuff that I find lacking from the films, which I'm sure you don't miss in the books, is the passage of time. I find...
You mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, I find especially with, like, Into the Half-Blood Prince and the Deathly Hallows, there's always this Christmas break and there's always the season passes. Because every movie tends to happen over the course of a year, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a school year.
Yeah. But what they don't seem to convey, while the weather changes and sure you get that, what I find they don't communicate is the time spent with certain people. So while I really like the whole Harry and Ginny Weasley thing, for me, for Harry's side, it came out of nowhere, right? Like I don't get any kind of, like, slow,
like the romance,
slow romance blossoming. I see when it happens, like once it starts to happen, you get it, you like it, the actors are good, like everything's fine. And from Ginny's side, you do, if you know about it and you watch the films for the second time, you, because I went into this going like, oh yeah, they're a thing, aren't they? And so watching the Order of the Phoenix, you can start to see the little glances from Ginny from across the room, or like Harry's talking to some other girl and she's a little jealous or something like that, but in her way, like it's not an outward over dramatic sort of way. But
I love Ginny.
Yeah, no, it's, she's great. And there, but there's this huge change even in her, I want to say Into the Deathly Hallows, and it could be the Half-Blood Prince, but I want to say the Deathly Hallows, where she's all of the sudden just like straight up flirting with him. And whereas before it just wouldn't happen, she'd be doing things like kind of take care of him, or she'd be like, oh, wow, Ginny's awful protective of Harry. That's cute. Like you'd notice that kind of stuff, but it's not really straight up. And there's no transition from being just kind of admiring and having a crush and doting on him, but not in an outward way, to just straight up, I'm going to kiss you now. And there's just no in between. And I feel like for me, what's missing is probably some passages in the books where, you know, like you either have inner monologue from Harry where he's thinking about Ginny, or it is Ginny, right? That's how you pronounce it?
Ginny, yeah. Yeah.
So it's like you have these things where like, or I don't know at any point if you ever get anything from Ginny's perspective, because if you do, that would shed a whole lot of light on stuff too, right? A simple conversation between someone like Hermione and Ginny, you know, because Hermione is spending so much time with the Weasleys. If she said, look, if you like Harry, you got to go for it. Like
the problem is you're like it, the books and the movies are kind of told from the perspective of Harry exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
And character wise, he's kind of oblivious in some cases.
Oh yeah. No, I get that. Yeah.
He's absolutely oblivious. Like he's sassy and he's kind of an asshole in some cases, which is great. Like I think one of my favorite, like just little moments of acting, and it's unfortunately it's not even on Netflix, which drives me nuts, but it's from the Goblet of Fire. You know, there's this whole discourse, like the other Hogwarts champion is this, you know, it's Rob Pattinson, but like, you know, he's depicted as like this handsome guy, he's like super popular, and Harry's a little bit bitter with him because he's going out with the girl that Harry likes.
Yes, I can't remember.
But Cedric comes up and asks him, he's like, how are you? And Harry just kind of looks around awkwardly and he goes, spectacular. Like, just in like the most like deadpan kind of voice. And he's had that sort of like, that personality has been ingrained slightly throughout the books. Like, he's very sarcastic. But that was like one of the first instances that I managed to see it in the films. But yeah, a lot of those moments that you're talking about, like, it, because it's told exclusively through Harry's perspective, those moments with like Hermione talking to Ginny, he's like, hey, go for it. It, like, Hermione mentions that, she tells Harry that at one point, she's like, I've been telling her to go for it forever. But you know, like, she does, like, that is obviously a conversation that's had, but it's, you're only seeing Harry's perspective.
But
only,
and ever. But that's how you get the information that Harry actually likes her back in the films, is Hermione says, I've seen the way that you look at her. And mm-hmm. you as a viewer are just kind of like, well, I guess, sure. But it, at that point, it sort of feels like, well, the script says so, so here we go, right? Whereas you don't necessarily get that feeling. Because like just in either, I can't remember, so unfortunately, because I've watched these last few nights in a row, so... 5, 6, and 7 are all kind of bleeding together in terms of, especially the little social cues and stuff, what happens there with
right.
who's dating who. But the idea that that Harry is into Ginny is on the heels of him being really heavy into this other chick that used to date Cedric.
Yeah.
And like 1 minute he's on the floor gushing about his first kiss to Ron and Hermione. And like in the next scene in my head, they're talking about his crush on Ginny. I'm like, well, wait, what? But what's happened yeah. is probably like a quick cut scene of winter, you know, and me probably meshing a couple of movies together for starters. So I'm going to get that out of the way. But like it's the time that passes in the film, nothing happens to really suggest that it's been a long, long time. And even if it does, it's just something arbitrary, like, you know, the weather changing or something. It's not like showing two characters in various positions in the castle, various locations, doing stuff together, and then having the seasons change, indicating, oh, they've been spending months hanging out, and that's why there's a new right. friendship, or that's why. Like, so I don't really understand that way. And I feel like, too, that probably part of the challenge from a filmmaking perspective, especially where they took the last film and split it into two parts, is that there's just so much happening in the books that it's just impossible. Mm. It's impossible to make the film not be 6 hours long. And it's impossible to make the film and have it include all of the stuff that you absolutely have to, because yeah. you can't leave out some of these key points of like finding the goblin sword, or, you know, Horcruxes and like all this kind of stuff. You have to leave it in there because it's key to the plot. But then the mm-hmm. film just kind of feels like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, I will say, like, in terms of like adapting I even found that while watching it too, like I kind of knew it was about to happen and what I was expecting, because they were trying to be as close as possible, and J.K. Rowling had a huge hand in the films as well. Sure. And she's like, these are all the key moments. I will say that the whole kiss between Harry and Ginny, though, the way it happens in the movies is not how it happens in the books at all. It's completely different.
Oh, okay.
So the way it happens in the books is like, so Harry becomes captain of the Quidditch team. Or he's like, he's, you know, he's on the Quidditch team.
Yeah.
He's the, captain the sport at one point. Team.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, Ginny is also on the team, and Ginny is actually a really, I think eventually going forward, like, you know, after she leaves Hogwarts and everything, I think she becomes a professional Quidditch player.
Okay.
Because she's just really, really good at Quidditch.
Nice.
And which is funny, because her brothers never used to let her play when she was a kid, and then she just got really, really good. So she became a professional. So she can play, I think, every single role on a team she could do, because she's just that skilled at it. So Harry was supposed to be in detention with Umbridge, who I'm pretty sure people hate more than actual Voldemort.
Oh, yeah. She's skin
she's
crawl
a piece of work.
Worthy.
Yeah. Awful, 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 awful. Like, amazing character. God damn, I hate her.
Oh, terrible. Holy human. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's bad. So yeah, he's supposed to be coming back from detention, for something. And, he didn't even get to play. So Ginny filled in for him as the seeker. They ended up winning. And then like in the middle of the celebration, like Ginny, like kind of ran towards Harry to be like, hey, look, we won, to give him a hug. And he just kissed her.
Wow.
In front of everyone. He was just like, all right, I guess this is the time. But like, this is after like, you know, a couple months of him, like kind of just being like, man, I'm thinking about Ginny a lot. That's weird. Like, you know, kind of like questioning himself about it a little bit. He's like, it's my best friend's sister. Is this weird? I don't know what to do. But it was also kind of a reaction with Ron's idea with it as well. Like, at first, Ron looked like he was going to be really, really, in the book, like, Harry was like, oh, should I just kiss Ginny? Where's Ron? I got to make sure this is okay. And Ron was kind of, like, looked horrified for a second, and he was just like, I mean, okay, I guess. Like, if it's going to be anyone, it may as well be you.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was in the book. I think it was done a lot better. I know that they were trying to, I think for pacing, they were trying to create more of like a softer, you know, moment between the two of them. Cause they don't really get a lot of moments together.
No. And I think that's where that lacks in the films is that you don't,
yeah.
Especially when they lead up to that, cause the kiss they do, they're in some sort of attic, some sort of chamber of mm-hmm. something. I can't remember what it's called.
They're in the room of requirement.
There we go. Thank you. And so
you are welcome.
Yeah. So, and it's a cute scene, like the way that she says like, this can stay up here too. Like she sort of like does it where no one is ever going to see, it's not going to become a thing. It's just them.
Yeah.
So it's like, this is between us unless you want it to be more than that. And that was a kind of a cute thing, but it went from being, I mean, she goes from being cute Ginny to like hot high school girlfriend Ginny. Like in a heartbeat,
yeah.
You know, and like just the confidence that comes out is, I don't want to say uncharacteristic, but it's out of left field from a film perspective, because again, you don't get the ramp up. Like there's not a lot yeah. of near misses. There's some, but there's not a lot of near misses. There's not a lot of tense moments between the two of them, because again, you, like you said, they don't get a lot of time. Just the two of them
together.
Know?
Yeah.
What I found propelled their relationship as well as the relationship with Ron and Hermione forward, which I would argue has more of a long pine. Like that has more of a long,
yes,
a long,
yes.
Burning.
You want to know what's funny though, is that originally that wasn't going to be a thing. Originally it was going to be Harry and Hermione,
which I'm glad didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I don't know. I really like that it didn't happen, because it kind of solidifies. It drives me nuts when like people can't just be friends in media.
Yes.
Everything always has to become a romantic situation. Mm-hmm. Always. Now, like, you know, like, but between guys and girls specifically, like, you know, if there's, you know, yeah. more, you know, queer romances in any direction, I'm all for that, because yeah. I think there needs to be more of that in representation anyway. But like just being able to have people, a guy and a girl, who are just like wholesome, legitimately good friends. And they're not afraid to be like intimate with each other, but not like sexually intimate, but just like emotionally intimate.
Yes. Yeah.
Which and still you... have it just be friends without it being like, is something going on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you get. Not only do you yes. get that, but they point it out. Like
they
in the Deathly
Absolutely.
Hallows, yeah, like there's a point where like there's a lot of stuff going down. People are dying. Everybody's really worried. They've got this huge task. And it's just the three of them. It's just Ron, Hermione, and Harry. As yeah. like as you had in the first movie, right? Like you're back down yeah. to the trifecta, right?
The trio, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a couple of points where like you can tell that, you know, Harry's worried about the outcome, Hermione is worried about Ron, and like and they're comforting one another, especially when Ron isn't around because he leaves the party at one point. Mm-hmm. And I thought that they handled that really, really, really well. Like you get that they're not romantic. You know, because
yeah.
they've already established that Harry has a big thing for Ginny, and that Hermione, as mad as she is at him, is still, you know, very much in love with Ron. And yeah. I don't know why we're dwelling on these relationships so much, but like it's one of those things where like it really, it's one of those movies that does that very, very well.
Yes.
And
that whole dance scene with them, that wasn't in the books at all
yeah.
either. Like the dance scene with Harry and,
yeah, in the tent,
and Hermione.
Yeah.
But yeah, but when that happened, I was like, oh, this is beautiful. This is
yeah.
nice. At first, I was like, where are they going with this? I was a little bit worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of became like goofy and weird. And I was like, okay, I see. This is perfect.
Yeah.
I was all for it.
What a friend needs, right? Like, that's
yeah.
what it becomes. That's what it's
yeah,
about.
Yeah, it was Harry reaching out to his friend and being like, I know you're sad. Let's mm-hmm. dance it out. Let's
yeah.
just be weird about it for
exactly.
a second. Let's get
exactly.
it out of our system.
Yeah.
But I think that's the heart of it. I know you're like saying, why are we talking? I feel like that's the heart of it though, like it's,
well yeah
there's no reason why Hermione and Ron would go on this huge mad hunt with Harry unless they actually legitimately loved him, right? Like it,
oh yes
it, you know, he's been thrust with the weight of the world on his shoulders, and you know, this unfortunate prophecy and situation that he's stuck in, but being able to have friends who are like, nah, no, we got you, even mm-hmm. though they really could just stay out of it entirely. They could have no part in it whatsoever, especially Hermione. She could have just been like, I don't know, I'm not even, I'm only here because I got a letter that says I was.
Yeah.
You know? Like, she could just completely wipe her hands the whole situation, but...
Well, no, I get that. I mean, and I get the whole idea of the point of the last few films is that you can't do anything on your own. You know, like, there's a lot of stuff like that. I find a lot of what's happening, too, with Voldemort really confusing, too. Like, something that I really, as a big criticism, I don't know whether this is in the books or not, but as a criticism of the films, it's like night and day. It's all of a sudden, Hogwarts is just completely powerless and full of people that can't fight back.
Mm.
It's like these Death Eaters are the actual wizards, right? They're the bad wizards.
Yes.
And then the Dementors are the skeletal things.
Dementors,
that fly
yeah,
around.
They're like the skeletal.
They look
ghosts.
Different in the later films than they did in the.
They do. I know. That's the one I think nail in the coffin for films like this when you have like a franchise series, but you have a different director for most of them. Mm. I think it was the same director for the last four.
Yeah,
Dale
Yates did the last four.
I think he started at four. I think he started at Goblet of Fire, then he did all of them from there.
Right.
Or if he didn't do Goblet of Fire, he definitely did Half-Blood Prince, or no, Order of the Phoenix, and went from there. But but yeah, they were first introduced in number three in The Prisoner of Azkaban. And they look similar. They have like a similar essence, but they do look different. Same idea. Very much the same idea, a slightly different look to them.
And when they attack wizards, it's the same sort of like your face kind of gets sucked off. You're like, your soul is getting removed, and like there's similarities. David Yates directed Phoenix, Half-Blood Prince, Deathly Hallow Part 1 and 2. Mike Newell did Goblet of Fire.
Right.
Alfonso Cuarón did Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah.
And then Chris Columbus did the first two.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so, and then from a screenwriting perspective, the first four and the last three were all Steve Knowles, whereas Michael Goldenberg did Order of the Phoenix. So it's one of those things where I just feel like Voldemort or these Death Eaters get out of Azkaban, and then all of a sudden it's just like, how did you guys ever put them in Azkaban if you can't do anything to protect yourself or the people around you? Like, it just, all of a sudden it's like all defenses are just gone. People just run away and hide. It's like, well, that doesn't, no wonder you're all cowering in fear and underground, because you can't fight back. Like, at no point, well, I shouldn't say at no point, but like, you very, very seldom do you see someone actually take out a Death Eater. You know, like, there's no one seems to be able to stand up to them. And you're just kind of like, well, what has been keeping these people from walking all over you for all of these movies? To me, it just felt too fast. Like, there was just a really weird switch that happened.
And I can see, like, thinking back at it, I can see how, see, in my brain when I first watched it, I'm like, the great, whatever. Like, it didn't make, you know, it was fine. I can see from, like, having never read the books, how that would translate really weird.
Mm.
I totally get that. And I think that I also kind of felt that way myself. I was like, well, that's a weird switch up. From my knowledge of it, I'm not trying to be like, well, here is actually what happened.
Because I don't know, right?
So Voldemort ended up not dying, but like the whole situation with Harry happened in the, you know, beginning of the first book, like, even like actually before the beginning of the first book, really. At that point, like, all of his followers kind of disbanded, and a lot of them either took off in hiding or like claimed that they were being controlled by a curse, or they were already arrested. There was like this kind of witch hunt going on, for no pun intended, for all the Death Eaters that were followers of Voldemort. So a lot of them were kind of now that their leader was gone, they were kind of a little bit more vulnerable. So there was these series of arrests and things that were made. And then when Voldemort was released, and they had like there was a mass breakout. Like, I think you see at one point,
in The Order of the Phoenix. That's the whole reason behind the film, is that Voldemort blows open the side of Azkaban and half of the people escape.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, and I think it's an issue of like, this happened off screen. Azkaban was essentially, basically disbanded because there was so many, previous, Death Eaters who had managed to get themselves into the Ministry of Magic. They kind of infiltrated from the inside.
Right.
And sent a lot of the good people to Azkaban while they took control of everything else, which means that they suddenly had control of the government. They had suddenly control of the schools. It was like a really, really, it was done over a period of years.
Right. But
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, they don't tell you that in the films.
Exactly.
Not in a way that you retain.
Exactly. And so I get where you're coming from, where it's like from an audience perspective, who's never read the books before.
Yeah.
There's a lot of holes. There's a lot of stuff missing.
No. And it doesn't help that Dumbledore is the only person giving you and Harry, which is essentially how it's meant to be.
Like, right.
You're getting the same information that Harry gets. And you're just kind of like, so much of this would have been easily addressed or fixed, or they could have been so much further along had Dumbledore just told Harry.
I know. And that is a criticism among the fandom as well. Like, people love the story, but it's like, man, there was even at Halcon one year, there was like, who made a worse headmaster, Yoda or Dumbledore?
Yeah.
Who was the worst headmaster? And I think Dumbledore ended up winning.
Yeah,
and it's,
yeah.
You know, it's just the fact that like Dumbledore just did that thing. He's like, oh, I'm just protecting the children and the kids don't need to know anything important, even mm-hmm. though they're directly involved because they don't have a choice because prophecy. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Like, I do think from a writing perspective and from like a character perspective, on one hand, I get it. You have to create drama. You have to create a reason to keep coming back to it. But holy crap.
Yeah. No, it gets really, really frustrating.
It gets kind of monotonous.
Yeah, you know, there's all this time that Harry and Hermione are out in a tent, like reading books and staring at, you know, these little things that Dumbledore left them in the will. And it's just like, on one hand, I can appreciate secrecy, where like you don't want the information to fall into the wrong hands, so you have to leave it in the form of a clue for your, you know, your pupils to figure out. But at some point, it's just a matter of like, have it be a magical message. You know, like given the end of the Deathly Hallows part one, where Voldemort gets, I can't remember the name of it, the Elder Wand.
Yes.
He gets one of the Deathly Hallows from the crypt of Dumbledore.
Mm-hmm.
Why on God's green earth would Dumbledore take the most powerful wand and leave it there with him? In the most insecure place ever. Like, for example, they're trying to get all these Horcruxes, and all of them are trapped and dangerous and mind bending. And Dumbledore has the most powerful wand in existence just right here. It's in my hand. I'm dead,
yeah.
So take it. And it's just like, how was a Quidditch thing left to Harry and not the wand?
Yeah.
And to add insult to injury, half of the Deathly Hallows, Harry is without a wand, and it becomes a big problem. It's kind of like, dude, why? Why is
there's
this?
Again? There's I'm sure there's more book reasoning for that.
Yes, I'm sure there is too. And I also haven't watched the second part of Deathly Hallows. There seems to be something between Harry's wand and Voldemort's wand that is a problem, and that Voldemort can't kill him. He can only wound him or something. I didn't follow the logic because they cover it so fast. It's the kind of thing where the people that are steeped in the knowledge of the books and how wands work, it's the kind of paragraphs that you get between events and the world building that you don't get in film. So, I mean, I understand that there's different woods and there's different cores, and I know that they have different abilities and they help amplify, you know, wizards' powers and strengths and abilities and things like that. Then there was this really cool scene in one of the tents, and it was one of the funnier moments, where Hermione has made a little flame and Ron and Harry are chatting, and Ron's like, oh, here, I took this off of a Death Eater. Like, they're kind of dumb actually. So here's your new wand. You can use that one. It's nothing special. It's just a whatever. And then Harry tries to like amplify the little flame to make it a little bit bigger, and he turns it into like a giant blowtorch, and he has to reverse the spell almost immediately. And I mean, I laughed. Like, it was very, very funny. But it's just like, but what's so special about that wand, you know, that it did that? Is it Harry that's special, or like, does the wand really matter?
So again, more lore. This happened in actually the order. Nope, the Goblet of Fire. This is a note that is made. So Harry and Voldemort, their wands share a core. So right. there was, so like, you know, you get different, you know, cores and things. You get Unicorn Harry, you get Dragon Heartstring.
Yep.
Voldemort and Harry both have Phoenix Feather.
Right.
Both of them have like the Phoenix that gave their feathers for the cores. One Phoenix gave two feathers. Usually it's one per, like it's you know, only like one creature will give one part.
Right.
For a wand. But this particular Phoenix had two just spare feathers that were used. So those wands are kind of like twins in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're magically not, it's almost like magnets, trying to put magnets together, or trying to yep. like, mm-hmm. like, you know, the same polage. Polarity, that's the one.
I like polage.
English. Words, English.
Hey, we're talking wandage. You might as well talk about polage. It's fine.
Polage, there you go, right? So that was the thing that happened at the end of Goblet of Fire when Harry's trying to fight off Voldemort. They both end up launching a spell at each other at the same time, and then that's when they get that beam of light that kind of just gets stuck in the middle. It's not able to go anywhere.
Right.
And that also happens, I think, at the end of...
It happens at the beginning of the Deathly Hallows.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. So same idea. That's what's happening. So they can only hurt each other. They can't kill each other with the ones that they were given as, like, students. Like, the ones that you basically have throughout your entire life. That you choose a student that you have for the rest of your days.
Mm-hmm.
Because... it's the same core, so they're not willing to fight against each other, even though the users are willing to fight, the wands are not.
But here's the problem, is that in that scene in the Deathly Hallows Part 1, Voldemort isn't using his wand, he's using Malfoy's dad's.
Yeah, so then it gets into some weird tricky wand lore at that point where like I had to read this part in the book a couple of times and I had to kind of work it out a little bit. It's like a weird little bit of a map. So when you first choose a wand, it's basically like wands kind of have a sort of sentience in a sense. Like mm-hmm. They say in the beginning, wands choose the wizard. The wand chooses the wizard.
Yes. Yeah.
So the wand kind of chooses who they want to be faithful to. When a wand is taken from a wizard by force, or like there's a certain moment where Harry Power Draco kind of wrestles with him and grabs his wand and takes off. At that point, because Harry was able to overpower Draco, the wand switched its loyalty to Harry.
Okay.
Because Lucius Malfoy gave his wand willingly to Voldemort, it wasn't able to work for Voldemort because he didn't overpower Lucius. It was still loyalty to Lucius.
Okay.
Because he just handed it over. So there's all this weird, tricky wand lore business. So the Elder Wand kind of switches loyalties a bunch of different times. Even when Voldemort does get the Elder Wand, it's not loyal to him because he didn't get it properly.
Right.
So the way it was supposed to work, like it was Dumbledore's, actually used to belong to Grindelwald. That's in the Fantastic Beasts sort of lore. It used mm-hmm. to be his. And then Dumbledore overpowered Grindelwald, so that was his, and he had it for years. And then theoretically, what Voldemort was thinking, if I take the one from Dumbledore, it's going to be mine. But the person who overpowered Dumbledore was Snape, so it was actually Snape's wand.
Right.
And then when Harry, or when, you know, something happened... Malfoy actually overpowered Snape, so then the wand switched over to Draco. And then when Harry overpowered Draco, it switched over to Harry.
Mm.
So it's all this weird wand loreage that kind of where it switched alliances, allegiances. Mm-hmm. And the Elder Wand itself basically had, like, you know, it's the most powerful wand ever, so it switches its allegiances very, very firmly, whereas other wands may not have quite as much intensity about it, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Elder Wand is made by death, weird. Right? Something like I enjoy that animation story too. That little folklore bit.
I was so excited to see that. I was like, this is cool because it breaks up the kind of
Yeah, the gray monotony and get well. Yeah. It gives you some time passage. It gives you some lore. It gives you some very important information as to you know what. Well, it gives you a clear note on what Voldemort is trying to do, right? Like why he's not just trying to, not just trying to kill Harry. He's trying to acquire, you know, the Deathly Hallows. Like that's the mission that he's on. To try and overpower the wizards. So. It creates the we have to stop this before the end of the world, not just we have to fight back, right? Like it has to like, oh no, we can't just not let Voldemort win. We can't let him get these three items together. Like this is a bad, you know, it's a bad thing. It's the parallel to like we can't let the Death Star come online, right? Like we have to blow it up before it's operational because otherwise bad things are gonna happen. Same idea. Which is again is cool. Like there's a lot, there's a lot of parallels. Like I see a lot of parallels obviously between Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. And then I also see some Star Wars stuff in Harry Potter. Like it's a very unique thing. I'm not saying it's copying in any way. It's just the hero's journeys and the mentors and, you know, the lore and stuff like that. All of those things, all three of those things are all steeped in like mythology and folklore and things like that are very, very, very old. And it's just nice to see those through points in it. I do find that some of the pacing in the other films and the motivation of characters is just right out to lunch. And like, the Half-Blood Prince thing, I don't even know why it's such a big reveal that it's Snape, because like, it's just a name in a book for the film part of it. Now,
yes,
in the book, I'm sure you're hearing about the Half-Blood Prince an awful lot.
Yeah, I don't quite remember what... There is a huge significance about it, and I can't quite...
It's got something to do with the potions and stuff like that. But it's just I'm wondering if it comes clearer to me in part two. I might see that. There's probably some sort of like posturing explanation or something.
Actually, I think what it is, because typically... No, I might just be grasping at straws here because, again, it's been a long time since I've read them. I read them. Actually, I didn't read them this Christmas because it was a busy Christmas. But I know that the way the name Half-Blood Prince came around was that Snape is actually a half-blooded wizard, which means that he has a Muggle father.
Mm-hmm.
No. Yes, a Muggle father. And he... The last name is Snape, is actually a Muggle last name. His mother's last name was Prince, so I think that's where he kind of took that from. So he technically is a half-blood prince.
Right.
I think what's interesting about that though is that Voldemort typically only takes pure-blood Death Eaters. And Snape was a Death Eater. And I think that's kind of where that significance comes from.
Mm.
Was the fact that like, oh, Snape managed to be a Death Eater, but he was only a half-blood. I'm sure there's more to it. Definitely.
Yeah.
There's more, way more to it than that.
But
I think that's part of it a little bit.
Yeah. I think part of it too is that, you know, like I would probably find these books particularly interesting. I just don't want to muscle through the other ones because I read the first one. It was okay. Like I'm well beyond, you know.
Started reading them when I was like 9.
Oh yeah. And I missed the craze because they happened a lot. They were aimed at people a lot younger than I was when they first came out. But
yeah.
Cause I was in my 20s. But yeah, like it's, again, like it's something that I've been enjoying watching, and I'm not as critical about the Deathly Hallows. I remember really not liking them in theater. I just thought that they were really long. It could be the fact that I'm watching them at home and I can pause and do the dishes, or I can take a break, you know, when I want. I do recall and will say, and then we'll move on, that I did not like the end of The Order of the Phoenix, and I remember not liking the end of The Deathly Hallows either. I don't know what it is about them. I just dislike, and I'll use The Order of the Phoenix here because I have not watched The Deathly Hallows in 10 years. So I don't want to talk about it in a way, you know, that I'm not familiar because it's been such a long time. But at the end of The Order of the Phoenix, Voldemort gets inside of Harry's head and he basically Care Bear stares him out of it. and it really bothered me. Like it's like really happy, warm, fuzzy feelings is how you beat Voldemort. That's it. That's all you got.
Kind of.
Yeah. Like it just like like
Care Bears.
Like it just to me is come on, dude. Like stop it. Like I feel sorry for you. You'll never feel loved. Oh my God. Really?
You know what though?
Have a spine.
Okay, so it's that's a legitimate thing though, because Voldemort was conceived under. I know it's ridiculous. Voldemort was conceived under the effects of a love potion.
Okay.
Which means that, so interestingly enough, as well, Voldemort is all blood. He had a Muggle father, you know. Where was I going with this? So because he was apparently, according to J.K. Rowling, when you're conceived under the effects of a love potion, you do not have any, you are unable to feel emotional affection for anyone. It doesn't exist. So I think that's kind of why.
Sociopath, nice.
Kind of. Well, yeah. have you watched the films? Like, look what he's trying to do. Like, love is not a concept that he understands. Like, so, I mean, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's like most hero stories are going to be like, oh, love conquers all kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, that's a thing that they kind of harken back to a lot. Like, the whole reason why Harry was able to survive the whole first encounter with Voldemort in the first place was that his mother sacrificed herself for him, which kind of put this like protective energy around him or something, and that, you know, it's
well, see, no, that's what I thought was the whole reason why, as to why, you know, he killed Voldemort, or Voldemort was destroyed by this curse that his mother, you know, protective, you know, the protective curse that his mother made by sacrificing herself. But then in these later movies, they say, oh, no, you guys are tied, there's a prophecy that ties you two together, and that you can't kill one another, so in order to kill Voldemort, you're gonna have to die too, Harry. Like, there's they and
yeah,
Dumbledore just almost puts that straight out there. It's one of the few facts he actually lays out for Harry. But so you're thinking like, well, so which is it? Is it prophecy or is it like, well, they seem to change their tune, which I find.
It's kind of chosen prophecy. So in number five, I'm pretty sure it's in The Half-Blood Prince. When they go to the Ministry of Magic and they find, like, they try and find this prophecy. It was Madame Trelawney. It was like the divination teacher, Emma Thompson.
Thompson.
Yeah. Right. Nope. Emma Thompson. Yeah. She was, cause I know Emma Watson is Hermione. Emma Thompson is Madame Trelawney.
Yep.
The crazy seer, but she actually did this prophecy where she, you know, foretold the Dark Lord, like, rising to power, and he would be, vanquished by a boy born at the end of July. And, it was really ambiguous as to who the prophecy was about. Cause in the books, cause the books have way more information that's able to, there's this little plaque in front of it that says, from prophesied by Madame Trelawney to Albus Dumbledore about the Dark Lord, and with a question mark, Harry Potter. And it basically he chose his nemesis, because the other option could have been Neville.
Right.
Neville and Harry are only born a couple days apart.
Right.
I think Neville's born like a day before Harry or something. So it's the fact that, like, it was technically prophecy. So it was a prophecy, but the fact that it was Harry was by choice and by chance, I think, because Voldemort was like this kid. I don't remember why he was like this one.
I don't
remember why.
Well, it sounds to me more like it's the fact that it was Voldemort killing his parents. Whereas if he had killed Neville's parents and Neville's mom or father had sacrificed themselves in the same way that Harry's parents did, that it would have been Neville that we're all talking about, not Harry Potter.
Well, no, because it was, so the only reason why Lily put Harry in the first place was because Voldemort had chosen Harry as the one that needed to die for him to rise to power.
Oh, okay. So that's lost information. Yeah,
and that's all lost in the books, right?
Yeah,
or all lost in the films.
I haven't watched the first films in like forever. I read the first book within the last couple of years, but it's still foggy.
It doesn't even really, it kind of explains the whole like mark of love thing, like how Harry was able to survive because of his mother's love. That's kind of where the first one gets into that. And then it's sort of in the end of the fourth book into the fifth book, into the sixth book, that it kind of gets a little bit more into, okay, like here's what's happening, especially the fifth book where you actually get the prophecy. And the prophecy ends with, neither can live while the other survives. So one of them has to die in order for the other one to live.
Hmm.
So I, again, there's a lot of nuance. It's been a long time since I've sat down and like unpacked everything, but,
Well, it's, but yeah, I mean, like, it's very similar in depth and scope to like things like Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and, you know, all the appendices and like there's a lot of extended world building and stuff that, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I do still like them, even though they're not the best films. The overall world that they paint, the lore that they adhere to, while confusing, is seemingly pretty solid. Like they don't make stuff up as they go along, right? Like the story, you know, that Rawlings did, it, like, has everything has like a rhyme and a reason and an order and a,
yes,
you know, stuff to it. So, and I, again, like, I'm looking forward to just finishing it up and reminding myself about how it all ends. I feel like, doesn't the last one have like three endings where like it shows Harry and Ginny like 20 years in the future or something like that? Like there's another.
Yeah, no, specifically 19 years later.
Yeah.
Which I know a lot of people had a weird, they're like, why 19? That seems like a really arbitrary number, but yeah, no, it was, yeah, it's, you see them all kind of grown up with kids and kind of what happened after the fact.
Yeah.
And it's, in my brain, it was kind of nice to see because it was like, all right, because really, if you just were to end it at the very, very end, it's basically just Harry being like, all right, I'm done. I'm going to go have a nap now, I guess. Yeah. Like, that's pretty much how it ends. And all of them kind of just at the very, very end of the Battle of Hogwarts. That's kind of what happened with that one. But,
it's the same with Lord of the Rings. If you're reading the Lord of the Rings books, when they win, when they defeat Sauron, it's like two pages. And then the rest of the book is just walking home.
Yeah.
It's a very short passage when it's like, and then the Dark Lord was destroyed and everything was good. And then the eagles came and then it's just this long, long, long walk home.
It's just like, oh man. Well, it was 18 months to get home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember that being a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so I find that with these kind of things, it's one of those things where like you don't. So I find true sometimes that, you know, it's a series where the directors have a hard time ending it because, you know, there's a hard place to find a really good ending. There's because a lot of heavy stuff has just happened and you kind of want to have there be a happy ending, but the happy ending can't happen tomorrow. Like it has to happen down the line.
Yeah. Well, know? And that's also a book thing too. Like the 19 years later thing was,
yeah,
it is in the books. You get to see like Harry's, you know, family and, you know, Ginny and his three kids and, you know, Hermione and Ron's kids. And
before we wrap this up, out of curiosity, has there ever been any rumors of a return to Hogwarts with like Harry and Ginny's kids and the Weasley kids? Like, have it be just a different generation?
I don't know. I don't think so. I know that she's not opposed. I don't think she'd be opposed to writing like at least a one-off of it. But I kind of have a weird issue with that though. Like, not that I dislike the idea, but I find like next generation stories for me are just a little, like, they're really bittersweet and I find I'd never like them as much.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I'm not saying it would be like, good.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that is, I feel like,
I mean, at least it would be consistent anyway, but, yeah. I guess the next generation story kind of is the cursed child. Cause it does pertain to,
which one's that?
It's a stage play, but it's also, you can buy the script as a book called The Cursed Child. And apparently it's fantastic. It's phenomenal from what I've heard I think maybe some biased sources, but I've heard, but a lot of people really, really enjoy it. Obviously, it was on the West End in London and now it's on Broadway now. So, So the fact that it's going to other cities is pretty great. I've never read it. I feel like I need to. Some of the stuff that happens in The Cursed Child kind of ties back into Fantastic Beasts, which is like a prequel,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
And I've seen Fantastic Beasts, but not the second one.
Yeah, I actually liked the second one a lot.
I liked the first one a lot.
See, I was like, all right. I was all right with the first one. The second one, I was like, all right, now see it.
For the first one, I found that it was weird and different, but it still paid tribute to that world in a way that I was satisfied with. Like, they went in some different directions, and I kind of, in the same way that I give points to the friendship and how they portray the friendship between Hermione and Harry, I really enjoy is it a romance between, is it Newt and I say love interest. Well, not love interest, but we'll say interest, you know, whether it's a person, you know, whether they're romantic or just friends or whatever is blossoming there. That's awkward and weird. And
Tina Goldstein.
I think so. Her roommate is the one that falls in love with the baker. Right.
Her sister. Yeah.
Sister. Sorry. And sister. Yeah. Yeah, so, Queenie. And they're really cute, right? Like that couple is really cute and fun.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those movies where like, oh wow, we're not going to get the Hollywood kiss. That's awesome. You know, like it had a lot of different kind of direction and things that we're just not going to play to popular opinion just because everybody else does it. Like, this is going to be a slightly different film, and cause he's a slightly different character, and like, mm-hmm. there's enough in there that kind of keeps you guessing. And I liked that. I haven't seen the second one I haven't had the opportunity to see it.
Yeah. I actually really enjoyed it quite a lot. It does kind of get into the romance a little bit too, but you can also see like Newt is also very emotionally invested in this woman named Lita.
Yes. Which they touched on in the first one too.
Yes. And her name is Lita Lestrange. And I don't know if you recognize the name, but Bellatrix Lestrange. Yeah. So they're all kind of like, it's that sort of like the entry into the whole Voldemort thing. So this is like Grindelwald. This is the Dark Lord before Voldemort.
Yeah, because where
Dumbledore kind of got his claim to fame.
And Dumbledore is played by Jude Law?
Jude Law, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a much
younger Dumbledore, of course.
Well, it's in the 20s, right?
And
I think the Harry Potter series, like Harry Potter, his group is kind of, it's like in the 90s?
90s, yeah.
The 90s a little bit?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah. I don't know. It's a fun little world. Like, I really enjoy the building. I highly recommend reading the books. I know like now at this point, if you've kind of missed the craze, it's really hard to read them. Especially since they, you know, people age with them.
Yes.
Like I aged with the book. So
Which
for me,
smart.
Like going back and reading the first one, I was like, oh man, these are some children. And as an adult now, I'm just like, well, boy, kids. Okay. Like, you know, it's a simple book. It's not very complicated.
No.
But also an easy read, but you can kind of see how they grow up and go through all these different emotional experiences and you know, just growing up essentially while also trying to deal with this, you know, war that's, you know, impending doom and everything like that. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that anyone read this series. Like, I think it's, you know, there's enough world building even in just the series itself, just that series, that it, you kind of, you're only getting one story and you're hearing about other stories, but it feels contained in itself. It doesn't feel like anything is too crazy far-fetched. But I think that, I mean, I haven't read The Cursed Child, so I don't know much about it myself, but I know that with Fantastic Beasts, it's sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's sort of just like extending the world a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Some bombs were dropped in that movie. I'm really interested to see how that gets resolved in the future, because holy crap.
Oh, in the second one? Well,
yeah. If you ever watch it, maybe, because that is, there's a lot that happens. Now, I think it's meant for, it's definitely a fan service film. Like, I think it's definitely meant for people who are really, really invested in the world a lot,
mm-hmm.
because it drops some names and it drops some things that, you know, if you're really into the world, you know a little bit more. I think if you weren't super Actually, you know what? No, I think anyone could like it. I think it would surprise anyone. I take that back. It's nuts. It's great. You should watch it.
Oh yeah, it's not something I'm avoiding. It's one of those things. Yeah. I'm just waiting for it to come on Netflix or, you know, right, have an opportunity to watch it. So, yeah. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this episode of the Citadel Cafe. If you have your own opinions about Harry Potter, I'm sure some of you do, or tips or things like that that you want to correct me on, then send a message into thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. The links to these movies on thecitadelcafe.com. I don't know why the whole shebang is not on Netflix. That's a little frustrating. I can't say I was going to go back and watch the first one, but I would have also liked to go watch maybe the Prisoner of Azkaban and just kind of get a little bit farther back than starting in at number 5.
Number 4.
Yeah, it's just not a thing. You get a little bit of a recap in the Goblet of Fire in the Order of the Phoenix, but you get the bullet points, but that's about it.
Yeah.
The music for the show is composed by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, and Spotify. And of course, word of mouth is an easy way to support the show. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then poke a friend in the arm, tell them to listen to it as well. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online at joelduggan.com. That includes my illustration and design portfolio. If you're interested in hiring me, then just drop me a line on the website. Don't forget to tune into my other podcast. That is the Spun Chunks, where I talk about Minecraft with my friend Johnny. We have a big guest coming up this Monday. We've announced it on the Spun Chunks this week, but we are going to be talking to Grian, who is a YouTuber, a member of Hermitcraft, and has been playing Minecraft for a very long time, and we're very excited to talk.
Yeah,
it's going to be a lot of fun. He's also a hoot. Like, watching his videos, he really knows how to have a lot of fun in a social gaming situation. He brought a lot to the Hermitcraft season this year. So speaking with Grian on Monday is going to be fantastic. So you can check that over at thespunchunks.com. And that's about it for me. Megan, where can people find you online?
People can find me online on Instagram at Megan Townsend and Twitter. And if you want to follow my personal project, The Heir of Keldanan, H-E-I-R, that's also on Instagram as well.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. Unless you need all three Deathly Hallows.